Good day. Today is Monday, 30th March 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel if, once you've watched this programme, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Now, the single most important piece of news coming out of the Middle East conflict that I saw this morning was one which was actually published about 2 days ago and which was reported in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, but which I'm afraid I missed when it was published. And this was a report which says that 80% of Iranian missiles launched against Israel get through and strike their targets. And I saw this news in an article that appears in Military Watch magazine, one of this infinity of military magazines that are published in the United States. And it says the following: Israeli sources confirm Iranian missile strikes have 80% success rates as air defences falter. And the article, this is the Military Watch magazine, continues, the Israeli paper Haaretz has confirmed that 8 out of 10 Iranian missiles launched against Israeli targets are reaching their targets, following mounting reports and growing quantities of footage pointing to the failures of Israeli and US ballistic missile defences. The report further noted that success rates have continued to improve as air defences have become increasingly strained. Israeli analysts observed that contributing factors have included the systematic exhaustion of the air defence network and the destruction of US forward radar systems in allied Arab states such as Qatar and the UAE, which have limited the quantities of queuing data that can be provided. Sources further observed that mass bombardment by Hezbollah in Lebanon has further strained Israeli and US defences. Now, I have here to add a cautionary note. This article in Military Watch magazine derives from an article in Haaretz. I have not read that article in Haaretz. And Haaretz, which is a left-of-centre newspaper in Israel, very critical of Prime Minister Netanyahu and of his government, and very critical of the foreign policies and security and defence policies the Prime Minister and his government have followed. Well, Haaretz is not a neutral source anyway. However, I have consistently found Haaretz to be a reliable reporter of events in the Middle East and in Israel itself. One has to allow for their biases, but I have never known them to let their biases interfere in reporting important facts of this kind. So I am going to ride with this story. I'm going to assume that it is true. Maybe 80% is overstating what is happening, but let us assume that it is 50+% or 60% or something like that. A large proportion, probably a majority, maybe the bulk of Iranian missiles are penetrating US and Israeli defences and are striking their targets in Israel. And of course, we've now had strikes on Israel conducted by Hezbollah, as this article in Military Watch magazine says. And there have also been further strikes on Israel carried out by the Houthis in Yemen. Now, At this point, I would not be myself if I didn't just add a further point, which is that Israeli air defences have been repeatedly spoken about as amongst the best and most advanced and most sophisticated in the world. This has also been claimed for US air defences too. The TAD and Patriot missile systems are repeatedly spoken of as incredibly effective, immensely successful systems, at least in the PAC-3 variant, fully capable of shooting down ballistic missiles. And of course, in the conflict in Ukraine, the Ukrainians and their Western supporters have echoed and reinforced that narrative that Patriot missiles are incredibly successful, supposedly, in shooting down Russian ballistic missiles, Russian cruise missiles, even Russian hypersonic missiles, missiles like the Kinjal and the Tsarkon. And these claims have been repeated entirely uncritically by the media in the West. Those of us, myself, for example, but also several others, many others, who have been deeply skeptical about these Ukrainian claims and have made that fact known for several years, well, at times, I won't deny that it has been, the exercise has been a little bit like talking into the wind. Well, bear in mind that the Iranian missiles are penetrating air defences which are essentially based on the same technologies as the air defences that Ukraine has been operating in its conflict with Russia since 2023, at least when the first Patriot missiles started to be delivered to Ukraine. And, well, we now have articles in the Israeli media and in the US military media saying that 80% of Iranian missiles are penetrating the air defences and getting through and are striking their targets. And, well, I don't believe that Iranian missiles are more capable than Russian missiles. This is in no way to knock Iranian missile capabilities. It's just to say that I'm confident that Russian missiles are as good or perhaps even better. And, well, it seems to me that this revelation discredits the claims we've been hearing over the last 3 years about Ukraine's extraordinary success in shooting down Russian missiles. Now, anyway, let's put that aside, though it does have relevance concerning the situation in the Middle East. I discussed in my program yesterday that the Ukrainians, Zelensky himself personally, are now presenting themselves to the Gulf states and the Americans especially as the world experts in combating drones. After this piece of information, the piece of information in Military Watch magazine, that claim should be treated especially skeptically, just say. But anyway, the key fact is that according to Military Watch magazine, based, as they say, on an article in Haaretz, Israeli air defences are faltering. There are increasing gaps in the coverage and large numbers, a big proportion of Iranian missiles are getting through and are hitting their targets. And this is, of course, taking place right across the Middle East, from one end of the Middle East to another, as the fighting intensifies. And it is important to stress that as of this morning, despite all of the talk about negotiations, about the Pakistanis setting themselves up as a mediator, the Pakistani foreign minister had more to say about that yesterday. He had this meeting with the Saudi, Turkish and Egyptian foreign ministers in Islamabad. He spoke about plans to set up some kind of a ceasefire. He said that China supported Pakistan's mediation efforts and its ceasefire efforts. As we will see shortly, the Chinese actually have quite a lot to say about the war, and I will touch on it in a moment. But anyway, the Pakistani foreign minister was talking about all of these things. He was talking about setting up some kind of system to regulate passage of ships through the Strait of Hormuz. Again, no real explanation of why Iran, at this stage in the conflict, would agree to anything like that. At the moment, all of the pressure from countries like the Arab Gulf producers, the Saudis, and by the way, the Pakistanis, despite their long-standing friendly relations with Iran, all of the pressure from all of these countries seems to be placed on Iran to get them to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, oblivious to the fact that for Iran, keeping the Strait of Hormuz under control is what gives Iran the greatest leverage over the United States and Israel, ultimately, going forward. But anyway, for all the talk of all these negotiations, there's every indication that the military situation is intensifying, that the war is, in fact, escalating. And, well, there were reports about 2 days ago that the Israelis conducted strikes against Iranian steel-making facilities, Iranian steel mills in 2 Iranian cities. One of these steel mills, I don't know if it was one of the ones that the Israelis attacked 2 days ago, but one of Iran's biggest steel mills, as I well remember, was actually constructed in Iran by the Soviet Union in the mid-1960s and early 1970s, after the United States and Britain and the other Western powers, at that time the Shah of Iran's erstwhile allies, refused to provide backing or support. Anyway, I am not going to cover that old history in this program. But anyway, the Israelis attacked these steel facilities. There are claims being circulated that the Western powers have never wanted to see Iran industrialize. And these attacks on these steel plants is part of that process, that there is a genuine plan, an ongoing plan, to de-industrialize Iran completely, to reduce it again to its pre-industrial levels. Well, that may be true, and it may be part of the rationale behind the attack on the steel mills. At least that may explain, and maybe one of the reasons why the Israelis would want to attack these steel mills. But in fairness, or at least it is important to point out, I don't mean that it's fair to attack steel mills, it is nonetheless true to point out that steel mills, by definition, do form part of a military industrial system. They provide the raw material for shells, for fortifications, for armoured vehicles, for guns, for all kinds of things. And no military industrial complex can function in any country or in any place without steel. Having said that, again, I would make an observation of my own here. Steel plants are amongst the most difficult things to put completely out of production as a result of attacks from the air. The history of the Second World War showed that. I doubt that Israel and the United States are capable of shutting down Iran's steel industry completely. The only way that could be done would be through the total destruction of Iran's energy system, which, as I discussed several programs ago, I think would be a colossal task, one which would require a sustained aerial offensive far more intense than the one we are seeing now, and one which, moreover, would have to continue for many months. But anyway, the point is that in an industrial facility which has a mostly civilian use was attacked by Israel in Iran, and the Iranians immediately retaliated. They carried out their own counter-strikes against facilities in Kuwait, and some of the reports that are circulating this morning speak of one of these attacks having struck one of Kuwait's desalination plants. The plant, in fact, which provides 35% of Kuwait's fresh water. If so, this is an enormously ominous development. It again shows the extent to which this war is spiraling out of the control of the people who launched it. And of course, if attacks on desalination plants continue, if the Israelis and the Americans continue to conduct attacks against Iran's civilian industries, well, then the crisis that we are seeing in the Middle East will have only begun and will eventually get far, far worse, with implications for the global economy I don't even want to think about, just to say. Now, alongside all of that news, we've had more, frankly, surreal comments from the President of the United States. He gave a meandering, as the most polite word I can find to describe it, a meandering interview to the Financial Times. He said that it would be a wonderful thing if he could gain control of Iran's oil industry. He said that capturing Harg Island would be a very easy thing to do, that he hasn't yet decided whether or not to do it, but it might be something that he might decide to do. Of course, Donald Trump has repeatedly said that all sorts of things in this war are easy. Before the war even started, in the week before the war, when reports were circulating in the media in the United States that General Kane and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the CIA were advising that in the event of an attack on Iran, regime change might not be achieved, and that the government there might in fact strengthen rather than weaken. Anyway, the President, Donald Trump, was very unhappy about those articles which appeared in the media. He was very unhappy about suggestions that General Kane had doubts about the entire enterprise. And he published a Truth Social post in which he also said that an attack on Iran would be easy, a very straightforward thing to do. And General Kane would be fully on board doing it. He was, after all, the same General Kane who had been successful in all sorts of other military operations and this operation would be amongst the easiest ones that he would have been asked to carry out. Of course, the last point is my gloss on his words. Donald Trump didn't exactly say it in quite that way. But he did say that it would be an easy operation. Well, here we are, 4 weeks later. We're into the fifth week of the war. The government in Iran looks as strong as ever. It probably has been hardened by the war. It is rejecting Donald Trump's insistent calls for negotiations. It is making immense demands of the United States. It is pounding targets in the Middle East. We have articles in the Israeli and American military media that 80% of Iran's missiles are getting through and are striking targets in Israel. There is no sign of Iran relaxing its control of the Strait of Hormuz. As I said yesterday, my sense is that, on the contrary, the Iranians are tightening their control on the Strait of Hormuz. I think it is time for the president to stop talking about this easy operation. I think American servicemen who are being deployed to the Middle East in ever-increasing numbers, there are more reports of more thousands of men being sent to the Middle East. According to some claims, the total number now either there or being assigned to the Middle East is around 50,000. I think American servicemen and women in the Middle East, the people who've had to evacuate the bases which the Iranians have been attacking, the people who operate the AWACS aircraft, one of which was destroyed, as I discussed yesterday, the people on the Gerald Ford who've had to contend with collapsing toilets and laundry fires and months on military station far beyond their official tour. I think that these people, to the extent that they spend any time listening to Donald Trump at all, and I suspect some of them do, must also be getting extremely exasperated about the president constantly telling them how easy the whole situation is. And of course, if you're trying to manage matters in the global economy, if you are having to contend with oil prices, which are again, as of today, moving steadily towards $120 a barrel, you too probably do not find the current situation easy. But anyway, that was what President Trump said to the Financial Times about any operation to capture Harg Island. And, well, he again seemed incredibly vague about what his overall objectives were. He spoke again as if victory had, to all intents and purposes, already been achieved. He's been saying this now for, well, basically the whole of the last 4 weeks. In which case, why do we still have a war? Why are Iranian missiles still striking Israel and hitting their targets there? Anyway, Trump was again extraordinarily vague about his objectives and continued to be incredibly vague about his timetable. I have to say that despite some efforts to claim otherwise, it does seem to me that, for the time being at least, the United States has no coherent plan as to how to conduct this war going forward. It looks as if there's still debates and discussions about what to do with these Marines and what to do with the 82nd Airborne Division, which has been deployed to the area. There are still talk and discussion about kind of lightning operations deep inside Iran, either to gain control of the enriched uranium or to seize some place or other. To what end and for what purpose and for how long, nobody seems able to say. Anyway, there's an awful lot of that being discussed and floating around, but there doesn't seem to be anything like an actual plan, a serious plan for victory, which is probably far beyond the available resources that the United States has brought to bear in the war. And, well, in the meantime, as I said, the conflict escalates. We've had the attack on the Iranian steel mills, and we've had the counterstrikes by the Iranians on the facilities in Kuwait. And there's every reason to think that things will continue to escalate and will continue to get worse, with every possibility that at some point the Houthis will start to take action against Saudi oil exports through the Red Sea. And, well, I saw in Bloomberg that there are now discussions, apparently serious debates, among some people in the West, in the industries, about the prospect very soon of $200 per barrel oil. So there it is. Maybe the president does have some ace up his sleeve. Maybe the military in the United States does have some great plan to achieve victory. I don't know what it is, but then I'm not a military person, as I've discussed many times. I have to say, with every day that passes, with every week that passes, that doesn't happen, it seems to me that the case that there is no such plan, that there is no ace of that kind in the pack, that case grows stronger. Well, here I would like to touch on, since I've spoken about military matters, I want to touch on two things. Firstly, I've had some pushback from some people who say that I overstate the capabilities of the US Special Forces units. Well, I have had the privilege of actually speaking to people from Special Forces units, former Special Forces units, except, by the way, from people who served in the Special Forces units of the United States. I've heard word about these Special Forces units, both from people in NATO, and, by the way, from people in Russia. And their general view is that the American ones are as good as it gets. They're not supermen. They're not superheroes. Obviously, they can't do some of the things that they're shown to do in Hollywood movies, a point that somebody rather acidly made on the thread of my previous video. But they are very, very good indeed. What I have also heard, though, and this has been more from Western military people, is that perhaps because Special Forces units are of such high quality in the United States, and, by the way, in Britain as well, British and American politicians are over-tempted to use them, asking them to do more than is humanly possible and expecting them to achieve the impossible. And that beyond that, staffs in Washington and London had become over invested in special forces and in special forces operations, and have shown less interest and understanding and given less attention to what to the needs of the more conventional line infantry, the infantry divisions, who are the people who must in the end win the wars. And I think this is probably true. It does seem to me that speaking of Britain, and I think the same is true in the United States. When I was younger, say in the 60s or the early 70s, special forces units in Britain and the United States formed part of a very, very large, very complex military system, in which there were infantry divisions, there was aircraft, aviation, all of these things, and every part of it complemented and supported the other. What has happened over the last decades is that all of those other parts have shrunk, whilst the special forces have remained at roughly the same level and have, if anything, grown bigger and have received even more funding. And the result has been a distorted military and a distorted sense of priorities. Well, I've said it, I'm not going to push the point. I am not expert in these matters. That's one thing I did want to say. The other is a point that's been made to me over the last 24 hours by somebody very close to me personally. And he's made what I think is a completely valid point, which is that the United States has never engaged in ground operations in any theatre of war in which it did not possess overwhelming air superiority since the fighting in North Africa in 1943. And, well, air superiority of the kind that the United States is used to might not be available in the Persian Gulf. As we have seen, the Iranians have immense strength in drone warfare and in missile warfare. We've seen that the air defences in Israel appear to be failing, and that seems to be the picture right across the Middle East. Sending men into battle without air superiority is something that the United States has not done for a very long time, that it isn't used to, and that it might not have properly trained for or prepared for. And I do wonder whether that is understood at the level of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And of course, I doubt that the President himself and some of the people around him, Senator Graham, for example, have any grasp of it. If American soldiers land on Harg Island and the Iranians launch hundreds, maybe even thousands of drones against them, what exactly is the air defense that America could put up to repel those drones? Just saying. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say about the situation in the Middle East. For the time being, as of today, it seems to me that what we see is just an escalating war. I don't think any of the talk and rumours about negotiations seriously. The President spent much of last week pretending that negotiations were underway. Well, it's obvious that that is not the case. I have repeatedly pointed out that it clearly isn't the case. And, well, in the absence of negotiations, And in the absence of any clearly defined way forward, the whole situation on the ground continues to deteriorate in exactly the way that I said. Now, here it's perhaps worthwhile to return to the question of China and what the Chinese are doing. Now, I read a report, can't remember where, that Iran, some days ago, maybe a week ago, rejected a Chinese offer of mediation. I have seen absolutely nothing to that effect in the Chinese media at all. It was in a Western media outlet that I read it. I suspect that this is an attempt to create trouble between Tehran and Beijing. In my experience, if the Chinese do suggest mediation, do put themselves forward as mediators, they do so publicly. They say so, mediators in an armed conflict of this kind, they would do so publicly. You would see it brought up in readouts of conversations, say the ones between Wang Yi and Araxi, and you would see some hints of it in the Chinese media, but I have seen absolutely nothing like that at all. There are also reports, I also saw reports yesterday, that the Iranians have refused transit rights to two tankers carrying Persian Gulf oil to China. Again, I've seen no report about this in the Chinese media. Maybe the Chinese media would not report this story. Perhaps it's true, perhaps it's not. Perhaps it's Iran registering with China, its annoyance at China's efforts to get Iran to accept its mediation. Just saying. But up to now, again, I must say this, I've seen nothing from Beijing that would suggest that the Chinese are interested in offering their services as mediators in that way. But there has now been some very interesting commentary in the Chinese media. Firstly, there was a very interesting, very long article in Global Times, which is a Chinese newspaper, after all, and but one which is moreover particularly close to the Chinese government. It is published by the People's Daily, which, as I have pointed out many times, is the official newspaper of the Communist Party of China. Anyway, this editorial, its title is "A Month into the Conflict, It's Time to Press Pause on This War." And the article continues. It has now been a full month since the US and Israel launched military strikes against Iran on February 28th. Far from achieving their so-called intended objectives, this conflict, which was initiated by the US and Israel without justification amid negotiations, has edged steadily toward the brink of losing control. Although it is uncertain how this conflict will end, its shock to geopolitics and the global order is already profound. What is urgently needed now is to prevent this conflict, one that should never have happened, from sliding into the abyss of complete loss of control. And in order to make it absolutely clear, even more clear, who China blames for this debacle, this editorial comes with a cartoon. It shows a destroyed and burning Middle East. It shows a picture of the Dove of peace being burnt and hovering over the destruction is the shadow of Uncle Sam, complete with his top hat. So there's no question at all who the Chinese are blaming for this disaster. They're talking now, and this is for the same editorial, what is most alarming is the erosion of limits on targets and the sharp rise in the risk of spillover. The conflict is no longer confined to military objectives. Both sides have begun striking key civilian infrastructure, including oil refineries, desalination plants and power stations, facilities vital to national economies and everyday life. Once this mutual destruction mode becomes the norm, it will trigger even more severe humanitarian disasters. The Houthi movement's declaration of entry to the war not only opens a new front, but also heightened risks along the Red Sea shipping line, increasing global oil prices and logistic costs. And the editorial talks about protests against the war in Israel. It brings up again the killing of the 168 girls in Minab in Iran on the first day of the war. And then it finishes, China has made it clear that the urgent priority is to achieve a ceasefire and stop the fighting as soon as possible. This is a war that should never have happened, and it brings no benefit to any party involved. The history of the Middle East repeatedly teaches us that force is not the solution to problems. Armed confrontation only adds new hatred and breeds new crises. We once again call for an immediate halt to this conflict to prevent the situation from escalating further and to avoid the spread of war. So China has now spoken and has made it quite clear that it wants a ceasefire, and it wants a ceasefire as soon as possible. This is not just because of problems with export of oil from the Middle East to China. It is because the Chinese are increasingly worried that the situation in the Middle East is drifting towards, as it puts it, the abyss of a war without limits. China, like Russia too, by the way, finds that kind of prospect horrifying. It worries about the mounting proliferation risk, that this is not something that the Global Times editorial talks about. And for that reason, it wants the war to stop, even as it makes it perfectly clear that as far as it is concerned, the party that is responsible for the war is ultimately the United States. So it could be that over the next couple of days, we will start to see Chinese diplomacy becoming more active. We might even see visits to Tehran by Chinese diplomats and Russian diplomats. And it will be very interesting to see, by the way, should something like that happen, how the United States and Israel will respond, whether they will moderate the bombing. I would say that one of the events that deepened and escalated the Vietnam War was a disastrous decision that the United States made in the mid-1960s, before any US troops had been sent to Vietnam, to bomb Hanoi, the North Vietnamese capital, at precisely the time when the Soviet Premier, Alexei Kosygin, was there on a visit. That infuriated the Soviets and hardened their decision to provide further assistance to the North Vietnamese. Well, we'll see whether in Washington, especially, where they appear to take little notice of history, they will repeat that kind of mistake all over again. Anyway, it's likely that we will see what we will start to see what the Chinese are going to do. But notice that in this editorial, unlike their friends, the Pakistanis, the Egyptians, the Turks, and the Saudis, the Chinese are making it absolutely clear who they feel bears the ultimate responsibility for the war, and who, by extension, must make the most important concessions, and that, of course, is the United States. Now, President Trump apparently wants to go to China in mid-May. He has postponed his trip until then. It is highly likely, I would say it is all but certain, that if Trump does indeed still want to go to China in May, that the Chinese will also use that fact as a means to increase the pressure on him and on the United States to agree to a ceasefire, which will involve significant concessions to Tehran. Well, as to China blaming the United States primarily for the war, you have a further statement, also from Global Times, expressing China's frustration, complete exasperation with the Europeans and their failure to speak the truth about this whole conflict. And this was in an article, also in the Global Times, but one actually written by Global Times. The unaccountable G7 joint statement on Iran exposes the group's weakness. When the foreign ministers of the Group of Seven concluded their meeting in France on March 27th, they issued a carefully worded joint statement. It called for an immediate cessation of attacks against civilians and civilian infrastructure, and urged the permanent restoration of freedom of navigation through the Strait of Hormuz. The statement named no party, raised no question of accountability, and proposed no binding mechanism for follow-up. It was a document of studied emptiness. And then further down, in the same article, Global Times asks the question, why could the G7 not bring itself to say simply, stop bombing? Of course, as it goes on to answer in the same article, it's not going to say, stop bombing, because that would be addressed to Israel and first and foremost the United States, and that is not something that the European states or the Japanese dare to do. And well, China obviously has no such fears. They're going to be perfectly forthright when they talk to the Americans and say to them, you brought this about. You've caused this debacle. It is you who must stop. We will talk to the Iranians. We will see whether there is something we can do to persuade them to stop as well. But ultimately, the responsibility for this disaster lies with you. That, it seems to me, is the fundamental difference between a power, however, whatever your feelings about it, a real power, a great power, which makes its decisions, which makes its own decisions and conducts its own foreign policy. And these spineless yes people who inhabit the government offices in Europe. They all know how the war came about. They aided and abetted in the commission of the war, and they twiddle their thumbs and they have nothing to say about it. They're engaging in no preparations either. We see Bloomberg talking about $200 a barrel oil. And what are the Europeans and the Japanese, but specifically the Europeans and the British, doing about it? Are they checking to see the size of their reserves? Are they in contact with industry to understand how much oil industry is going to need over the next year, specifically over the next winter? Are they looking to see what the shortfalls are? Are they debating to themselves? Are they engaging in exercises of finding out whether there are other raw materials that are going to be in increasing short supply, and concerning which the problems are likely to exist? Are they checking stockpiles? Are they starting to ration stockpiles to preserve a reserve to keep economies at least functioning through a period of crisis that appears to be looming? No, they're doing no such thing. In fact, the entire discussion, at least in Britain, appears to be about whether the government should pay out further subsidies with money it doesn't have at a time when it is already in overwhelming debt, to try to cover people for their energy bills once prices rise. As for reserves, as for husbanding reserves, as we see what all of the Western powers are doing in the face of a looming energy shortage, is deplete their reserves as fast as they can to keep oil prices just a little bit lower for just a little bit longer. Personally, if we find ourselves in a situation, say in late autumn, when there are huge shortages of vital energies, energy products, oil and gas, and enormous shortages of other strategic materials right across the economies of the West, causing stoppages and blackouts, and we have a situation where the reserves of all of these things have been depleted to critical levels, I will not be surprised. And by the way, I will know who in that case to blame. It would be no different, of course, from the decision to start a war in the Middle East against an adversary like Iran at a time when missile stockpiles in the United States are already depleted, without any real plan and without any real idea of how big the missile stockpiles of the other side actually are. Anyway, this is what I'm going to say today about the situation in the Middle East. There's an article today by Con Coughlin, a journalist in the Daily Telegraph, who points out that the conflict between Iran and the United States is now ultimately a proxy war between Russia and the United States that the Russians are providing assistance to the Iranians, and it is Russian aid that supposedly is keeping Iran in the war. By the way, the last point is certainly an overstatement. Russian aid may be helping Iran, and I believe it is significantly helping Iran, but I think it would be going altogether too far to say that it is keeping Iran in the war. The stability of Iran's political system is what ultimately is enabling Iran to sustain the war. A point I have made many times, and which we have also made many times on the Duran. But anyway, Con Coughlin, of course, never asks himself the obvious question, why, if the Russians are helping Iran, why is that surprising? Why should that be any surprise to anyone, given the enormous assistance the Western powers have given to Ukraine? Was it not likely, was it not in fact even inevitable, that eventually, if the West gave the kind of aid to Ukraine that it has done, that the Russians would look for payback somewhere else? Just so. Of course, that possibility never appears to have crossed the mind of people like Con Coughlin, who always advocate war. Coughlin has been a major supporter of giving Ukraine everything the West has got and going even beyond that and not talking to the Russians whatsoever. He doesn't ask himself the question, what would have happened if the West had followed that advice and had then sought to start exactly the kind of conflict with Iran on the 28th of February that it did start? Would it have actually started that conflict without any weapons at all, because all of them would have been given to Ukraine? Anyway, maybe I'm giving too much time to exploring the logical fallacies of Con Coughlin's mind. But, of course, I devoted a great deal of time to the Chinese in this programme. The same applies equally to the Russians as well, given that they do seem to be the people who are providing most of the military aid to Iran at this time. It is they, the Russians, who arguably have even more leverage over Iran than China does. One might have thought that the Americans would understand that. One might have thought that a US official would be flying to Moscow to discuss with the Russians the possible way forward and how to get out of this crisis. But of course, nothing like that is actually happening. In the meantime, all of the reports speak of this ground operation being prepared. As I said earlier, a ground operation, the first one since 1943, conducted by the United States in conditions where it cannot claim undisputed, unqualified air supremacy over the battlefield. We shall see how it all goes. Now, at this point, I will return to the topic of the conflict in Ukraine. There has been some significant amount of news on the battlefields. I have been sceptical of some of the claims that I've seen that the Russians have actually started their spring offensive. I still don't believe that this is in fact the case, but it does seem as if the Russian military are gradually becoming more busy, more active on the battlefronts, and as if more things are starting to happen. Yesterday, I mentioned that it looks as if the Russians have have almost achieved the elimination of the Ukrainian pocket, the cauldron on the east bank of the Oskol River in the Kupiansk sector. But there's been significantly more reports since then elsewhere on the battlefronts. Specifically, there are now further reports that the Russians have renewed, both from the east and the west, the advance of their pincers towards the town of Orekhov in Zaporozhye region. I don't have details of what is going on in these operations, but the groups of forces involved in these operations are apparently reporting this fact or facts that would lead to that conclusion on their websites. And there have been some reports of a Russian advance from the south into Orekhov itself, and even some claims that the Russians have broken into Orekhov, though I see no confirmation of this. But perhaps the most interesting and important news comes from the Donbass. Firstly, it seems that there is now heavy fighting underway, not just in Belitskaya, but west of Belitskaya for control of the Belitskaya mine. Belitskaya, small town north of Rodinska and Pokrovsk that the Russians have been seeking to capture. It's heavily fortified. It has many high-rise buildings. It looks as if the fighting there is intensifying, and that over the next few weeks, Belitska, which is mostly surrounded, will probably fall. But the most important news, it seems to me, is coming specifically from the town of Konstantinovka, which is the area where much of the most intense fighting has been underway. And it yesterday, the Russian newspaper Rayedovka claimed that the Russians have broken into the central area of Konstantinovka, the industrial sector, and that they're now fighting for control of the factories there. The Rayedovka report reads as follows: the week's main success was the 8th Guard Army breakthrough in the center of Konstantinovka. Assault units have entered the industrial district, securing the Krasny Oktyabr plant and part of the railway station near the metallurgical plant. The Ukrainians were not expecting an attack here. The Ukrainian garrison was preparing for an attack from the south, from Novodmitrovo, but the breakthrough came from a different direction. And the article continues: the Russian military planned to occupy the industrial zone before the enemy could turn it into a fortified stronghold. The experience of Krasnogorovka, Volchansk, and Kachasov-Yar has demonstrated that whoever takes a factory first dictates the terms of the battle. Capital buildings and underground utilities make it possible to hold out for a long time, even in isolation. So anyway, this is what Rayedovka said. The interesting fact is that there's now video footage, which the Ukrainians themselves have released, which does indeed show Russian soldiers in the process of capturing these factories in the center of Konstantinovka. I don't believe that the Ukrainians were unaware that the Russians were going to attack these factories. If the Ukrainians were unable to offer much of a defence at these factories, what it suggests to me is the exhaustion of the garrison, which has been pounded from the air for weeks by the Russians and whose supplies have been mostly cut off. Anyway, this is dramatic news from Konstantinivka, and it may suggest that we are now past the turning point of the battle for that town. And there's been further news in the Liman area. The Russians appear to have captured more positions to the west of Liman. It has been claimed that this has essentially cut off the supplies to the Ukrainian garrison. In Liman, the Ukrainians supposedly, or at least according to some claims, are now in effect surrounded there, dependent on one remaining road, which some say is not surfaced, with the option of either retreating or staying where they are and facing total encirclement in another cauldron. Well, all of this may explain recent things that have been happening in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, the two remaining big fortified towns that the Ukrainians still control in Donbass. There are reports that the Ukrainians have now begun an evacuation of civilians from both of these cities. By the way, something I think that does need to be said, the Ukrainians overall have acted with consistent responsibility in evacuating civilians in urban areas before battle takes place in those urban areas. There's been talk of human shields, and I'm absolutely not saying that that has not happened, but mostly, and this must be said, evacuations of civilians have taken place. And they appear to be underway now. First, the school children are being evacuated, then presumably other civilians will follow. And, well, there are now reports that the Russian drones are regularly operating over the skies of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, that the Russians have begun, in other words, the aerial part of their offensive over those two towns, that Russian drones are busy closing the access routes to both of these towns. I remember some months ago, my friend Brian Beletic made the point that if the Russians capture Liman and Sviatogorsk, and they are on outside and probably in control, in fact, definitely in control, of at least parts of those two towns, that if the Russians reach these places, then their drones, their first-person view drones, their FPV drones, their fibre-optic drones, would have the necessary range to be able to choke off the access routes into both of these cities. And that would be from the northeast. But, of course, with the Russians now active in places like Belitskaya and in the Dobropolye area, the Russians probably also have advanced drone positions west of these two cities as well, enabling them to close the access routes even further. So it's clearly still possible to leave and enter Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, but it does look as if we're in the early stages of the siege of these two towns. And of course, the pattern in these two towns, I'm sure, is going to follow the same pattern that we've seen in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd And in Konstantinovka at the moment, the Russian infantry will then start to infiltrate into the towns. The position of the defenders, the Ukrainian defenders, will become more and more ragged. The Russians will take up more and more positions. The supply line, the control of the supply lines, will gradually tighten, and the point will eventually come at some point in the summer when the collapse takes place. We are at that point now. The battle for Slavyansk, Kramatorsk has begun. The last phase of the Battle of Donbass. I doubt that the fall of Donbass, the fall of the whole of Donbass, or if you prefer, the liberation of Donbass by the Russians, will by itself end the war. I think the Russians now definitely do have further territorial objectives in Kherson region and Zaporozhye, obviously, but I suspect at least in Kharkiv and Odessa. Just saying. But saying all of that, it is indisputable that if Ukraine loses Donbass, the original cause of the war will have been resolved in Russian favor, and the Russians will be in a position of overwhelming advantage from that point on. All of this may explain, by the way, why Zelensky is again saying that he's prepared to sit down and negotiate with the Russians, even if he's not prepared to make any concessions, and why he's also pushing back against Rubio's allegations that he, Zelensky, has lied about the American demands. Zelensky insists that he is not a liar. He says that he is describing the American demands accurately. Well, I'm not going to waste time debating it. Anyway, that's in this war where we are. Given the drama of the Middle East, I wonder how many people care now. We should care. The war in Ukraine remains critically important. But anyway, this is my take, both about that and about the general situation in the wars today. Let me remind you again, you can find all of our videos on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Don't forget to check out our new Substack site. Last but not least, please remember, if you like this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this platform, to this channel. That's me for today. Have a very good day.